wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. This is your host, Norm Diamond. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer and engineer. This is the first Old Mole of 2021. Happy New Year's to you. Or is it? I'm not questioning the joy of our world or our society. There'll be enough of that questioning as our program proceeds. But the very concept of a new year and celebrating it. Here's what Antonio Gramsci had to say. Gramsci, you'll remember, gave us the wise advice to maintain optimism of the will along with pessimism of the intellect. As a 25-year-old, he published a piece titled, "I Hate New Year's Day." Here's some of what he said. "I hate these New Years that fall like fixed maturities, which turn life and human spirit into a commercial concern with its neat final balance, its outstanding amounts, its budget for the new management. They make us lose the continuity of life and spirit. You end up seriously thinking that between one year and the next, there is a break, that a new history is beginning. I want every morning to be a New Year's for me. Every day I want to reckon with myself, and every day I want to renew myself. No day set aside for rest. I choose my pauses myself when I feel drunk with the intensity of life and I want to plunge into animality to draw from it new vigor. I await socialism for this reason too, because it will hurl into the trash all of these dates which have no resonance in our spirit, and, if it creates others, they will at least be our own, and not the ones we have to accept without reservations from our silly ancestors." Spoken as a callow youth, albeit one who would become a profound revolutionary thinker. On today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Al Weinrub on the need for local community sources and systems of energy to replace the vast centralized systems that predominate now. As part of our continuing series, Another World is Possible, I'll look at the worldwide trend toward increasing authoritarianism in governments and the institutions of the state. Yes, it's not just the problem of a particular soon-to-be-gone president. And we'll look back to a frequent Old Mole visitor. Leo Panitch died just a couple of weeks ago. He died of COVID-19, which, outrageously, he acquired in the hospital while under treatment for cancer. In this piece from our archives, Bill Resnick talks with Leo about the 2008 crisis of capitalism and what opportunities for socialism resulted. Let's lead off with Bill and Leo Panitch, introduced by Old Mole Denise Morris.
The global left has indeed suffered a great loss with the passing of Leo Panitch. In his memorial tribute in Jacobin magazine, Vivek Chibber describes Leo Panitch as, quote, "incredibly warm, inviting, and generous to others, and he remained committed to the end to the cause of socialism and human emancipation." Chibber concludes his tribute, quote, "I have met few people in my life so warm, so inviting to others, soaking up every ounce of energy and knowledge that their experiences grant them. He was a pillar of the international left, but he was also a friend, and the world feels quite a bit colder without him." That is Vivek Chibber, Jacobin Magazine, December 22nd. Here in Portland, Oregon, Leo Panitch left his mark through his many appearances on KBOO Community Radio. Leo Panitch talked with our Old Mole, Bill Resnick, many times over the last 12 years, tracking the forces of empire, neoliberalism, austerity, and resistance. If you'd like to hear more from Leo Panitch on KBOO and the Old Mole, head to kboo.fm, and there you'll find an archive of interviews, including a discussion of his 2012 book co-authored with Sam Gindin, The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. This interview was produced in 2013 by longtime KBOO staff and programmer Kathleen Stevenson. This morning on The Old Mole, from the archive, March 2009, Bill Resnick and Leo Panitch discussed the particulars of the 2008 economic collapse as the Obama administration begins its first term with the challenge of protecting the interests of capital against the increasing pressure to support progressive reforms and the need for transformational social justice policies. Much has changed in the last 12 years as the election of Trump sparked mass protest and the growth of the left and progressive movements in the U.S. and around the world. These same movements are now poised to meet the incoming Biden administration with greater force and cohesion in 2021 than in 2009. What hasn't changed is the need for mass pressure from below. On behalf of the Old Mole Collective, we send our best wishes to family and friends who knew Leo Panitch best in life and struggle, our deepest gratitude for his boundless contributions to building that better world we so desperately need. And now, Bill Resnick and Leo Panitch.
Leo Panitch, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill.
Leo Panitch is a Canadian, writes and teaches about the U.S. and global system. He's a really big thinker, a sober thinker, but sees visionary possibilities. Leo Panitch, Barack Obama has been reading history about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obama and the administration apparently see themselves as having to save the Union and the capitalist system, too. Is this just political posturing, political positioning? How do you see the current crisis and the Obama administration's efforts so far?
Well, I think they are cast in the role that Roosevelt was to some extent in the 1930s, that is, of saving capitalism. And although Roosevelt, by 1936, was being called a socialist and even worse, a communist by many people in business, many people on Wall Street, he explicitly was oriented to saving capitalism and made no bones about that. And Obama is in much the same situation in what is the most severe economic crisis since the 1930s. The difference may be that it now looks like Roosevelt was rather more prepared to step on capitalist toes than Obama is. He was prepared, for reasons we could talk about, or was pushed at any rate in the 1930s, to do things that he thought were necessary to save capitalism that the capitalists with a much narrower perspective didn't like. Obama doesn't seem to be capable of asserting, either on his own or because of the people he surrounded himself with, asserting that degree of independence from the capitalist class in the United States.
You're referring then to the crisis in finance and the banking system and the absolute need to restructure it, yet he seems to be relying on a lot of the same old guys who have kept their positions and their bonuses.
Yes, and he seems very frightened that to do anything that might undermine their confidence further. So even though the banking system is completely dysfunctional, even though we can see that it serves a completely social purpose and that the whole economy is dependent on it, but nevertheless is held in private hands, in the hands really of very few people, he doesn't seem ready or capable of going beyond that to turn the financial system into a public utility. The result of that is that both the American economy and really the world economy is frozen by virtue of the fact that private bank lending is frozen and is just not profitable for bankers, and they see it as too dangerous for them to be engaging in lending. And the stimulus program, no matter how rich, won't have the kind of effect that people hope it will have unless it is multiplied by lending through the banking system.
What is the alternative to Obama's reliance on and really pleading with the bankers to begin lending again, which they aren't doing for actually good banking reasons?
That's
right. You really don't know the health value
of the assets they're holding.
Right, and the whether these companies or people or whoever you're lending to will survive the downturn.
That's right. And they're even afraid, let alone subprime mortgages and all of the derivatives built on them, they're increasingly afraid that the corporate bonds that they hold will be defaulted on, or the third world private or public bonds that they're holding will be defaulted on as trade collapses, as profits in the third world collapse, and so on. In that context, he is a prisoner of the reluctance of the banking system, having, you know, led us into this mess, to now get us out of it. And the alternative would be to indeed nationalize the whole banking system. Now, most people on the left in the United States then say, nationalize it, eat up the bad debt, and then sell it back after the public sector has eaten up the bad debt, has socialized the debt, as one can say. Give it back to the private bankers. That's what was done in Japan in the late 90s and Sweden in the early 90s. But in fact, that is a extremely undemocratic way to go. And what I would say this provides us with an opportunity with is to finally take this crucial element of our society into the democratic domain, into the public domain, and change the criteria upon which banking and really the decisions about what's to be invested, where it's to be invested, how it's to be invested, to finally take those decisions into the democratic public arena.
It's going to be a long time, though, before it seems to me the administration, they're going to have to be driven into it, and the American people are going to take your advice. It's not inconceivable, though, that they will be driven into it if the crisis keeps deepening and if the population gets more desperate and worried. It's important to talk about that right now, the necessity of it, and also the great potentials of it. How do we do that?
Well, it's not going to happen without tremendous pressure from below for it to happen. And that can come from a very, very wide variety of sources, from, you know, the workers who are not only being laid off but are being forced to reopen their contracts with the auto companies, even while the managers in the banks and the insurance companies hold on to their million-dollar bonuses on the grounds that they have contracts. But it doesn't only apply to working people who see the hypocrisy and the essential class nature of that. It also applies to small businessmen. It applies to professionals. It applies to people very broadly in the middle class who increasingly in this crisis can come to see how dependent they are on the decisions of a small group of private bankers. But it would need a tremendous amount of pressure from below. And what Roosevelt did that was really reformist during the New Deal, and it did make a difference to people's lives, was done under that kind of pressure. It was done under the mobilizations of the unemployed, the enormous mass mobilizations of people in the labor sector, which led to the great unionization reforms of the 1930s and so on. There was also a radicalization in the universities and in the media, which pushed all of this. Some of those people found their way with these radical ideas into the Roosevelt administration. But it was pressure from the outside as much as from the in, really more from the in, that pushed him in this direction. Mm-hmm. Now, Obama has called for people to put pressure on him. And one would hope that, that those people who were so active through the Internet and in door-to-door campaigns would be putting pressure on him now after the election. We'll have to see the extent to which that happens.
Yeah, I wonder if that call for pressure even if very sincere, and I suspect it may well be, it doesn't, in fact, take some of the pressure off, because those people who would have to be applying the pressure are hearing from him that somehow he's on their side. I'm working for you. Please. We'd almost be better off putting pressure on George W. Bush, at least in the United States now.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point.
Yeah. And then we 3.4 million people last week were on the streets in France protesting and challenging the government and frightening them to death.
Yeah.
It's not happening in the United States.
I think that's a very good point. But that also has to do, of course, with the decrepit nature of the American labor movement and the lack of organizational coherence of the American left. The French are capable of pulling off these one-day general strikes, and this one was bigger than usual given the context of the crisis. Nevertheless, they're capable of pulling these off because the left is far better organized, both in the labor movement and more generally in politics, than the North American left is in general. And what this is going to require is a transformation of the nature of trade unionism in the United States, some of which there are signs of it taking place in certain sectors, not least in California and out on the West Coast generally, but also via new political organizations. And there again, you could say, the hope that's been invested in a resurgence of the Democratic Party as a spokesman for working people and so on may delay that. On the other hand, it's to be hoped, and this was the case in the 60s, that as with the Kennedy-Johnson years, that this will give a fillip to movements and to political organization and political radicalism rather than be a damper on it. And that's what did happen in the 60s.
Leo Panitch, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Leo Panitch. He's done many wonderful books, lots of essays, one called The Globalization Decade, a book, a second, Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy, and the Imagination. We've been talking about the economic crisis, the Obama's efforts, the Obama administration's efforts that so far have been probably not commensurate with the degree of the problem, and also talking about the possibilities of big movements in the United States. Leo Panitch, your assessment of sort of the U.S. left and the labor movement, seeing them both as quite anemic and disorganized and unable to actually lead the kinds of struggles that would be necessary. That implies, though, that there's still something there, clearly, and it implies that it's going to take a while, and it may well be that we're going to have some time, because this crisis is likely to get worse, although one can never tell. Soothsaying is not our strong suit, but it does look very serious, and they're not going to be able to reconstitute in the old way. Am I right about that? It seems the financial bubble that kept the economy going for various bubbles for 25 years are not going to be reconstituted. Do you see that sort of long-term, it's going to be a long-term struggle that in fact, progressives can work in?
Yes, I think it is. I think that we have time, if you want to put it that way.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. Yes, I see this as a very, very serious crisis, and one that is going to last and that there's no easy way out of. And it is necessary, as you're implying, that people have patience in that context, and that they do come up with short-term reforms, immediate reforms, as well as generate a long-term vision and be open about the inadequacy of the short-term reforms. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders just last week called for a cap on interest rates on credit cards. And what we indeed are seeing is that the extent to which the American economy depended on working people, middle-class people, living on credit in a context where their incomes had been constrained for so long since the 1970s. They were able to keep up their standard of living through credit. And they now are in a situation where, although the interest that banks are paying if you put $5 into an account is practically zero, They're charging people 20, 30, 40, 50% on their credit cards as people can't afford to pay off the minimum debt. And Saunders has introduced a piece of legislation in the Congress that would put a 15% cap on these usurious payments. And that's good. That's a good thing. But it also speaks to the enormous inequity of that reform, that what is considered to be a good thing is that people should be paying 15% interest to the very banks that themselves are giving practically no interest to money put into the banking system. So they're making a profit, if you like, of 15 times what they're paying out. That should show the necessity of the reform and the inadequacy of it. And people ought to struggle for that reform, and then struggle for far, far more radical alternatives of the kind I was speaking of in terms of banking being a public utility. Those things are possible to combine in a political mobilization. And hopefully that is going to happen. And you can see that across the board in those areas where you're seeing a collapsing industrial sector. Let's take the auto sector. It is necessary to secure the kind of supports to keep plants in operation that are essential to their communities. But at the same time, it's necessary to be calling for, in the auto sector, for instance, the taking of that whole auto sector into the public arena. If you like, the nationalization of the auto companies and the parts companies, and their conversion into the production of things that people are really going to need, which is not private cars run on oil, on gasoline, on a fossil economy, if you like, but rather modes of transportation that are energy efficient, whether it's hydrogen or electricity. But more than that, the conversion of that industry into the production of things like solar panels to produce cheap solar energy, which is going to have to come in the next generation, and can come with enough investment in technological change. Yeah.
Even, in fact, if government now is not ready, in fact, to basically nationalize, although they have in some ways, and just sacked the president of GM today, but if they're not willing to nationalize and, in fact, are probably going to be trying to move GM towards clean cars and somewhat new energy system rather than, in fact, really converting into a very different kind of energy system and doing wind turbines and many other sort of necessary infrastructure elements, if they're not ready to do that now, they may well be in 2 or 3 years as if we, in fact, keep maintaining the pressure and build that vision. I gather that's the way you see it.
It's perhaps a bit more optimistic than I am about where they'll be 2-3 years from
right.
now.
Or 5 years or 8 years. And it seems to me all of American life now, the health system, the justice system, the energy system, there's nothing that isn't in contest now in certainly the financial system, as you discussed.
Yeah.
Everything now is being questioned and in contest. It's really an enormous, to quote Rahm Emanuel, I know you agree with that, a really deep crisis, a terrible thing to waste. We can put a left vision on the agenda now for the first time in a long time.
I entirely agree with that. And I would say something else about American political culture. There is a tendency on the part of the intellectual American left, at least, and the labor leadership, to think that what the United States has missed has been the Canadian or European type of labor or social democratic party. And it's my feeling, and I felt it for a long time, that that's mistaken, that those types of social democratic and labor parties are extremely hidebound, afraid of their own shadow, very much themselves caught within the limits of the system. And there may be something quite liberating to the fact that the United States doesn't have that heavy tradition. And it may very well be possible that the American left could blow past European social democracy to something that is more democratic, that builds in a positive way on the populist and progressive tradition in the United States, And it would be a mistake, I think, although I think this is going to be most common, partly because at least of the public health care debate,
right,
which social democracy gave us and not
Leo,
you.
Leo, I'm afraid we're going to have to, I'm getting the signal that we have to end.
Well, as we said, we've got lots of time.
We have time, and people are actually enthused. There is a vision. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Good to talk to you, Bill.
Right. So long.
Leo Penich was a dedicated voice, a thinker and activist for the possibility of a much better world and the strategy to get there. With him in mind, it's time for another episode of Another World is Possible. Back around the turn of the millennium, 20 years or so ago, a persisting dispute erupted in the normally placid dinner meetings of the Old Mole Group. Nearly the entirety of those who argued took the then prominent position on the left and elsewhere that the state was withering away, its functions being taken over by corporations and the market. I argued, on the contrary, that only some former functions of the state were being diminished, and that other aspects, especially repressive ones, would grow and would have to grow. Rather than withering, the state as an institution was torquing, not getting smaller as a whole, but lessening in some respects and vastly growing in others. This morning I want to look at how we understand the growing authoritarianism, the growing state repressiveness and ability to repress, not only in the U.S., but in the world. I apologize in advance, as one of my motives clearly is the less than generous impulse to tell my colleagues, I told you so. That was our theme for Another World is Possible. We've got the guillotine by The Coup. On Another World is Possible, we examine both the possibilities and the obstacles, both the visions and what stands in the way. We've looked at utopian and dystopian literature, police unions and alternatives to policing, what there is and isn't to learn from a country like Cuba, and the role of citizen scientists in environmental movements. Drawing on history and social psychology, we've begun a discussion on why and under what conditions people are open to rethinking their societies, to recognizing that fundamental alternatives exist. Growing authoritarianism, whether in India, Hungary, Turkey, Brazil, or a multitude of other places, is something the people of the world are up against. In the U.S., we've seen its trajectory increase under Democrat and Republican administrations alike. Replacing a would-be dictator with a more grandfatherly type as president will have little effect on the underlying tendencies unless the factors that produce them are addressed. Thus, today, I want to take a beginning stab at how contemporary social science understands those tendencies and factors.
We might be tempted to think that our democratic heritage automatically protects us from such threats. This is a misguided reflex. In fact, the precedent set by the founders demands that we examine history to understand the deep sources of tyranny and to consider the proper responses to it. Americans today are no wiser than the Europeans who saw democracy yield to fascism, Nazism, or communism in the 20th century. Our one advantage is that we might learn from their experience. Now is a good time to do so.
That was my sidekick for this morning, Patricia Kohlberg, reading from Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Snyder is a professor at Yale. 2 points immediately jump out. First, he's promising to help us understand the deep sources of tyranny in order to combat it. Second, his starting point is the equation of fascism and communism. That starting point is worrisome. I'm wary of approaches that equate the two. Yes, the regime calling itself communist that developed in the Soviet Union was oppressive and authoritarian. Stalinism was tyrannical. But the sources of that tyranny, to use Snyder's language, were different from the sources of tyranny in Germany and Italy. Their political histories, their underlying economic systems, their class formations were different. If we're to understand the deep sources, as promised, those differences are crucial. If we are to head off the growing authoritarianism in our own world, those are factors we can't just glide over. There's another clue in that paragraph from Snyder to the narrowness of what he means by deep sources. It's simply an article of faith for him that what we have now is democracy. Unquestioned, unqualified democracy. He sees no need to consider the ways in which our political system has always reflected the inequities of our social economic system, the ways in which it has facilitated those inequities, the ways, in fact, that what we have is one system that integrates the political, the social, the economic, the ways in which that system generates the language of democracy while blocking its substance. Snyder doesn't see a system at all, and thus looks only at the narrowly political. His deep sources, then, go no deeper than political maneuvering or the power drives that some humans have in excess. His lessons, as a result, are limited. They are good, common-sense bits of advice on being an active individual citizen. They are not about the need to address our economic system that distorts democracy. They are not about the need to join with others to build a movement. Turning from Yale to Harvard, Professor Pippa Norris also studies growing authoritarianism. She and her sometimes co-author, Ronald Engelhardt of the University of Michigan, understand it as a cultural backlash against the decline of traditional values and norms, a reaction by groups that formerly felt comfortable in the world, even if they lacked wealth and political power, but now feel under pressure or bypassed. In other words, they locate the authoritarian impulse not in the power drives of potential tyrants, but in parts of the population that devalue democracy, once racial and sexual minorities, or other groups that have been relatively silenced till recently, seem likely to outvote them. This is perhaps an overly simplistic presentation of their argument, which hinges on the cultural presence of minorities and the hitherto silenced, as much as on their voting. But once again, democracy is understood as formal procedures, as what we already have, instead of as what it should be, authentic power shared by all citizens. We'll revisit these and other academics in a future program in the hope of gaining insights to this problem of growing authoritarianism. For now, I want simply to point out what was predictable years ago. When government social services are cut, when the state's responsibility for the well-being of its citizens is diminished or even denied, when the economic system, through marketization and globalization, is less and less able to provide meaningful and decently paid opportunities for work, the need for ever stronger authority to defend this system grows. Police are militarized, prisons enlarged, organizations of police and corrections officers gain political power. The military expands to sop up unemployment. The executive branch of the government is strengthened. Mass media shift subtly to the right, etc. This has been the pattern under Clinton and Obama, as well as under the Bushes and Trump. Returning to Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny, his conclusion offers an insight.
Until recently, we Americans had convinced ourselves that there was nothing in the future but more of the same. The seemingly distant traumas of fascism, Nazism, and communism seemed to be receding into irrelevance. We allowed ourselves to accept the politics of inevitability, the sense that history could move in only one direction, toward liberal democracy. After communism in Eastern Europe came to an end in 1989 to 91, we imbibed the myth of an end of history. In doing so, we lowered our defenses, constrained our imagination, and opened the way for precisely the kinds of regimes we told ourselves could never return.
The system we have now is not inevitable. It could have been different. It can be so in the future. That sense of inevitability is disabling. We'll continue to explore potential alternatives as well as their obstacles. Another world is possible. This has been Norm Diamond on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, in the first of a two-part interview, Bill Resnick speaks with Al Weinrub, author of the paper Community Power, Decentralized Community Energy in California. We'll hear part two next week. Bill?
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Al Weinrub. It's not a household name in this country, but he's very well known in the National Energy Democracy Movement, which is dedicated to stopping global warming through local energy. And to do that, to stop global roasting, today nobody in this country has come close to what's happened to California to reconstruct the energy system, as well, of course, as transport and housing and offices, agriculture, and the rest. California is where Al Weinrub has tirelessly worked for the last dozen years in that energy democracy movement. He's now coordinator of the Local Clean Energy Alliance. He also coordinates a statewide California Alliance for Community Energy. He's an activist. He works with others. He builds the movements. He also writes and agitates. He co-edited the recent book, Energy Democracy, and also wrote Community Power, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California, which is available at the website of the Local Clean Energy Alliance. And he's written innumerable articles and op-eds and with lawyers, briefs for court cases and public utility commissioners and legislatures. Here's what a few notables said about Community Power, his short book. Here's Bill McKibben. One of the great side effects of moving to renewable power is that we will replace vulnerable, brittle, centralized systems that are too big to fail with spread out democratic energy sources small enough to be resilient. So, Al Weinrub, welcome to Cable. Power to the people.
Thank you very much, Phil. Nice to be here.
Al Weinrub, for me, if what we call civilization is to survive, if slow and accelerating global roasting is to be stopped, and soon, say the climate scientists, it must be with community energy in the lead. So, to begin, tell us about the development of community energy in California, how it got started, why cities and counties took over electricity supply in their areas. How it is that in California, half of electricity customers are served by public agencies. Well, first, Al, the state of community energy in California, how and why it got started, its victories, its potentials.
Well, that's a tall order of things to talk about, Bill. What I'm going to do is try to talk about community energy just a little bit in theory or in general, and then talk about the actual institutions. that grew out of that movement. So I think some of the quotes about my first book are appropriate when it talks about a decentralized energy system. I mean, when we're trying to deal with the ecosystem and the planet, it's not just about reducing carbon. We have to lead our lives in a way, you know, that's in harmony with the environment in every way. So the first thing when we're talking about a new energy paradigm has to be that it's, you know, in tune with the natural processes of the world, which means that unlimited growth just is not going to cut it. And one of the things that's enabled the notion of community energy, by which I mean community ownership and control of energy resources. Now, that can take many forms, but the idea is that the ownership of energy resources and how they're built, what they look like, needs to be community-based in order to really have a sustainable kind of energy system. The centralized energy system that we have now, where very large corporate entities control energy for the purpose of realizing profit and capital accumulation, that is an unlimited growth scenario that does not really meet the needs of our population. It's very extractive and exploitive, and it doesn't meet the needs of the planet to survive. So the notion of community energy, where we control those energy resources, is really predicated upon renewable energy technologies, which actually exist everywhere and can be harnessed everywhere and can be harnessed in such a way as to best meet local needs for sustainability and for equity, for economic development, and all those things that come from the development of local energy resources. The development of centralized energy resources mainly benefit Wall Street and large capital interests. So the notion of community energy really is that it is the kind of energy system, the kind of energy model that's based on renewable, decentralized energy ownership and control. So how did this really get started in California is another question that's very much apart from that sort of notion that I just put forward. What happened in California in around the turn of the century with the big Enron energy meltdown that happened in California after deregulation of the energy system, where Wall Street and the big energy brokers in the country in cahoots with the monopoly utilities in California just totally upended the energy system, actually brownouts and, you know, gaming huge increases in energy prices. And there was a reaction to that, which included both the bailout of the monopoly utilities, but a lot of antagonism to it. And out of that, you know, Paul Finn, who is one of the leaders in the notion of community choice energy, which is what the bill passed in 2002 was called, Community Choice Energy Bill, basically allowed for communities to be able to take over the procurement of their own energy supplies, you know, while the utilities still own the distribution systems and whatnot, but the actual decisions about energy and energy resources could be made by communities. And a community choice energy bill was passed then in 2002, which essentially allowed, you know, a city or a group of cities or a county or some jurisdictions to get together and say, okay, we are going to be in the driver's seat of deciding what energy resources we're going to use. So the push for a more decentralized energy or community-based energy system came out of the abuses of the big centralized energy system, and largely on the basis of wanting cheaper energy, of course, with the Enron meltdown. That was a huge demand. But also, this is the time when people started talking about renewable energy. So it was cheaper, cleaner energy became the driving force. And that was around 2002 when the bill was passed. The first actual community choice energy agency didn't get established until 2010, a good 8 years later. And this is because, of course, the utilities were totally opposed to having their prerogative to have a vertical monopoly. You know, that was something very antagonistic in their minds, and so they fought it. Yeah, they fought it in 2010 with a state ballot initiative, which was meant to essentially kill the bill by doing a constitutional amendment that required a two-thirds vote of any community to move to a community choice energy agency. And they went down in defeat, but mostly they shot themselves in their own foot, because such a constitutional amendment was offensive in very, very many ways. But still, community choice had a hard time moving forward because it was being fought in many other ways. In fact, in 2014, they launched a legislative effort to kill community choice. And I won't go into the details, but that legislative effort was supported by the monopoly utilities and the California Federation of Labor. And that looked like it was going to be curtains for community energy, at least in the form of community choice. But what happened is we got together, we formed a coalition of over 200 organizations all across the state. We're opposed to that measure through our activism and our agitation, and who for the first time learned what community choice was really all about. And based on that fight in 2014, well, that fight actually lost every battle at the legislature, you know, every committee, you know, it went sailing through the legislature until it got to the Senate. And on the Senate floor, we had created so much heat, so much storm, so much commotion that no senator wanted to introduce it on the bill, though it certainly would have passed. So it never came up for a vote. And that was a huge victory. And after that victory, you saw community choice agencies forming all around the state. The first one was in Marin originally, but then in Sonoma, in San Francisco, in the East Bay, down in the whole Bay Area, and then eventually all the way into Southern California, so that now we have almost 23 community choice agencies, which are all public agencies. Some are joint powers authorities between different cities. Some are single city agencies. But the whole idea there is that a public agency decides what energy is going to be procured on behalf of the jurisdiction and the terms of that procurement. So, and largely, we think of this as happening in two waves. The first one was mostly communities wanting cheaper and greener energy. Over time, that has changed. Cheaper, greener energy, you can still get through a centralized energy model. In other words, you procure energy from large solar farms and wind plantations that are remote from the community. It's cheaper and it's greener. But it's really not captured by the notion of community energy, which, as I described before, was, a real decentralized ownership and control. And what that means, in fact, is the development of new kinds of energy resources, local energy resources, these being like local solar, energy efficiency, reduced energy demand. These are all resources that are valuable to the community in managing their energy supply. We see now, more recently, energy solar plus battery storage. We see demand, controls for sharing and leveling energy loads. There's a lot of technologies and a lot of resources that can be used to create an optimized energy system that can really meet the needs of the community. I think I want to stop there, but just to get the idea that there is, this notion, this vision of community energy, where the community really makes decisions about the energy sources. And then there's the actuality of these community choice agencies, which are procuring energy, some still using a centralized energy model, but many moving toward using much more distributed energy resources, meaning renewable energy resources of the type that are under development now.
This is Cable Radio Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've talked to Al Weinreb, who coordinates the Local Clean Energy Alliance of the Bay Area. He also coordinates the statewide California Alliance for Community Energy. And we've been talking so far about the growth of community energy in California. My understanding, Al, is that over half of the customers of electricity in California are now being served by public agencies. Of that half, the first half is long-established public utilities, like in Los Angeles and Sacramento. But the other half did arise in the last 10 years that you described, with the community choice aggregation community energy agencies. Let's talk some about the great advantages. It's clean power. You discussed some of them. It's also, it creates jobs for working people. People can put up solar panels, local sources of energy installations, small scale, some larger scale, few almost utility scale, it's called, fairly large plantations. But doing that is something that anybody who has ever, any construction firm that's ever built a kitchen or a home or even a bathroom, the skills of that can be translated very easily into building a complete local community energy sources. Al, tell us, I think that there's another enormous advantage of community energy. It doesn't need those big grids that PGE, for example, ran through all the forests and dry lands of California, carrying enormous wattage of energy, losing a lot of electrons on the way, of course. It's fairly wasteful, those big grids. Community energy, it's confederated with other communities, adjacent communities, can be extremely reliable and with storage, of course, but without needing anything but modernization of the current grids. Now, let's talk about another great and so important aspect of community energy is it can be run very democratically with an enormous amount of public involvement, with neighborhoods in some ways deciding their fates and how the community energy is going to be built and installed and where. Tell us about the sort of democratic aspects. These are the possibilities.
Well, you covered a lot of territory there, Bill, but the essential point that you made is that you know, there's a technological aspect of energy, and then there's a political economic aspect of energy. And it's important to always be talking about both of them at the same time. So what's clear is that the technology for decentralized energy is available. It's renewable energy resources, as I mentioned before, and it can be distributed. It's a distributed energy model, meaning that those resources are available and can be developed everywhere. They don't depend upon, you know, big central nuclear power plants, you know, thousands of miles or hundreds of miles away from the users, or the same for coal or gas-fired power plants, or even for wind farms or solar plantations. There's no reason to have these things remote from the community when they can be developed in the community themselves. So technologically, this is a superior form of organization because it allows the energy development to be much more in harmony with people's needs, with the kinds of resources that exist locally, and so forth. So the idea is that the distributed energy model and that technology already exists. But who's going to control it? Who is going to make the decisions about what energy is used and under what conditions and where it's developed and what type? And clearly that should be in the hands of the communities that need that energy and can decide on those resources. So this has been the great movement of the last 4 or 5 years across the country, but in California, to have much more democratic control of this decision-making. So the question really is whether these municipal utilities that you mentioned, which now control 25% or so of California's energy to customers, and then now community choice agencies, which have at least half of what the utilities used to have in the way of a customer base. The question is whether these institutions are institutions that really do provide public decision-making and control. And I think we're facing basically two difficulties in that respect. The first is that in terms of the municipal utilities, most of them were built and function under the centralized energy model. Even though they're local utilities, their energy resources are developed remotely. They buy energy off the grid the same way as anybody else, and they mostly move just like the monopoly utilities themselves. LADWP was in Los Angeles was a municipal utility that was the last one to get rid of coal-fired electricity, for example. Not really that progressive. There's about 30 or 40 of these municipal utilities in California, mostly quite small. Do they really represent democratic structures? And then the same question with respect to community choice energy programs and agencies. do they really represent the needs and local decision making? And there's two pressures here that we have to contend with at the community level. The first is that the community choice agencies are under tremendous assault from the energy establishment in California, from the Monopoly Utilities, California Public Utilities Commission, to continue to maintain their dominance. And they continue to try to kill community choice, even though a state valid proposition failed in 2010 and a legislative effort failed in 2014. Now the main battlefront is at the California Public Utilities Commission, where all the policies and being formulated are essentially in favor of the monopoly utilities still, and in a way that they really bring into question the survival of community choice energy programs. So that's that's one challenge. And the other challenge is that these agencies that get set up tend to use a lot of technologists who come from the centralized energy model and who haven't really incorporated the notion of real decentralized energy and the fact that the community should be really in control. And so both of these have been problematic.
This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Al Weinrub, who wrote the short book, Community Power, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California. We discussed that for humanity to survive global warming, we need to replace expensive, wasteful, centralized systems that deliver profits to the biggest corporations and their financiers and are committed to exponential growth on this finite planet. It doesn't work. We have to replace them with community systems generating clean, renewable energy for a productive system in harmony with nature and its ecosystems. Next week, we'll discuss that while California has led the world in creating community systems, its public agencies that serve over half of California's electricity customers, they're facing severe problems, some instigated by their corporate enemies, some self-inflicted. Al discusses means that Californians, supported by folks around the country, can surmount those barriers. So tune in next Monday at 9 for the Old Mole on KABU.
That was Bill Resnick with Al Weinrub. Thanks to them and to Old Moles, Patricia Kohlberg and Denise Morris. A sad and special thanks to Leo Panitch for a lifetime in the struggle. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Till next week, stay safe and stay active.